It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Do you remember when Pluto was declared not a planet? It was 2006. The man who helped kick Pluto out of the Planet Club, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, received hate mail.
Hate mail from third graders because of this. Third graders. Crayon scrawled. Wait. Dear Dr. Tyson, put Pluto back in. Here's what it looks like. And my favorite, it says, and write back soon, but not in cursive. I don't know how to read cursive yet.
We care. We care deeply about this far, far away icy rock. And few people care more than my next guests. Planetary scientist Alan Stern and astrobiologist David Grinspoon were part of a mission to send a spacecraft to Pluto to explore what had never been explored before. Some people thought they were nuts. They're here to tell us why they went to Pluto and what they found. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Hey, great to be here.
Thanks a lot.
You just heard how angry people were about Pluto being demoted, kids and grown-ups. Will you remind us why, briefly, why Pluto got kicked out of the Planet Club?
Well, frankly, it was BS. That's what I call bad science.
I see. What was the reason, for
you know,
those who don't remember?
It was people like Neil, who are not experts in planetary science, but astronomers in a different field, who were afraid that school children would have to memorize the names of too many planets. I don't know how to get sillier with science than that. You know,
okay, if you were a third grader, you would have written to Neil in crayon saying,
in this
BS.
Case, the third graders were actually right. As planetary scientists, we never stopped calling Pluto a planet. If you're concerned with the properties of what a planet is, then a place like Pluto is sort of obviously a planet to planetary scientists. That astronomer's definition had to do with what was orbiting around it, and they sort of contrived it to keep the number of planets small. So the press reported it as a done deal, as the voice of authority, but the people who study planets kind of ignored it, and we still call Pluto a planet.
I guess officially, according to that body, it's a dwarf planet. So for one thing, I think people responded because Pluto felt like an underdog, you know, like who hasn't felt small and cold and isolated and kicked out of a club, right?
Absolutely. People actually seem to really identify with Pluto.
Yes.
It's one thing that we keep discovering, and we talk about this in our book, Chasing New Horizons, that the public support for a Pluto mission at times was really pivotal in helping Alan and his team rescue this mission when it was threatened many times. Tens of thousands of letters showing up at NASA saying, no, we want a mission to Pluto. And the public reaction when New Horizons finally got to Pluto was overwhelming. People love this planet.
Yes. Alan, I understand us going to the moon. I understand us seeing if we can live on Mars. But why did you want to go to Pluto?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. One was the science was just mouthwatering. It really represented a brand new class of planets that started popping up in the 1990s. Now there are more than a dozen of them known that are like Pluto, very far out there. And secondly, the exploration value is very high. We had explored all the planets out to Neptune, and exploring Pluto allowed us, the United States, to complete what we started in the 1960s, which is what Carl Sagan called the initial reconnaissance of our solar system. It was a little bit of unfinished business, a little bit of a dare. And we built and flew a spacecraft out there and made the first exploration of it, the New Horizons team. And that's what Chasing New Horizons is about, that project.
Yes. A dare. I mean, can you describe how hard it is to send a probe to Pluto?
Well, it was hard for a lot of reasons. For one thing, it's very far away, 3 billion miles. And we were the fastest spacecraft ever launched, covering almost 1 million miles a day. And it still took 9.5 years for this lone Sentinel to travel across all that distance. And we couldn't afford for it to break. We couldn't afford for it to make any mistakes. And it's one shot flyby of that little planet.
You've got to figure out where Pluto's going to be in 9 years and get exactly to that spot.
Yeah, in fact, we had to arrive within a little box about 40 by 60 miles after traveling for 3 billion, and we had to arrive within 9 minutes of the prescribed time, or the pictures wouldn't have turned out well.
Why was it that precise?
Because that's what it takes in order to do the experiments that we wanted to do. We had to fly through Pluto's shadow to study the planet's atmosphere. We had to arrive at just the known times so that we could make sure that the camera is correctly pointed at the planet and all of its satellites.
And you have to have the flash on, or else the whole thing is... waste. Yeah.
And it was a big flash.
You're nodding your head, David.
Yeah, I mean, the navigation challenges alone were tremendous. Ellen just told you the numbers, and the analogy someone worked out that is a true calculation is that it's the equivalent of hitting a golf ball from Los Angeles to New York and hitting a hole-in-one the first try. It's that precise.
How close did it get to failure?
You know, there were many times that this mission should not have succeeded. If you go through the whole story, you're left with an impression that it seems like incredibly miraculous that it did succeed. There were so many different threats that were overcome, many of which were before it ever launched.
There were political threats. There were technical challenges.
Why political threats?
Well, because there's a lot of competition for funding within NASA. NASA has a fixed budget. There are lots of good ideas.
Oh, the politics of money.
Exactly.
And then there was one intense crisis that occurred right at the last minute in terms of the journey to Pluto. On Pluto's doorstep, after traveling for 9.5 years, mostly without incident, from Earth past Jupiter onto Pluto, 10 days out from Pluto, something horrible went wrong and the spacecraft went offline. And for a while, they didn't know if they would ever hear from it again. They're barreling in on Pluto. They're going to pass it one way or another in a few days, and it may not be working. Then they get contact back with the spacecraft, and it turns out that it's messed up. All the files are gone that they need for the flyby. And this kicked in this incredible, heroic, round-the-clock team effort to rescue the mission just in the nick of time. It was really incredible.
Incredible now. What was it like then?
Well, our team knew that the chips were down and we really had to perform. And in fact, people came streaming in. It was a holiday. It was the 4th of July. And they ended up staying for the entire 3 days until we got it fixed. It was really quite a team effort. And that's how the book starts off, is with that existential threat to the flyby of Pluto. It's a thriller.
Again, the book is called Chasing New Horizons. New Horizons is the name of the space probe that flew past Pluto and took some photographs. We're talking with Dr. Alan Stern, engineer and planetary scientist, principal investigator of that mission, and Dr. David Grinspoon, U.S. Library of Congress Chair of Astrobiology. So, 3 years ago, the New Horizons probe did it, got close enough to Pluto to photograph it, and what was the most important thing we learned from that?
We learned that small planets like Pluto, just about the size of the United States, like a continent instead of the size of the Earth, could be just as complex and just as active as their larger brethren like Earth and Mars. And that was
not
expected.
How is it complex and active?
Well, take a look at the pictures and you'll see Pluto has flowing glaciers, frozen lakes, a water ice ocean on its interior, 5 moons, a complex active atmosphere, volcanoes the size of Mauna Loa, and I could go on.
And none of this was expected. You know, the sort of textbook view we had before New Horizons got to Pluto was that small planets like that, so far from the sun, would be kind of dead and inactive and just covered with craters.
Like our moon.
Like our moon.
A rock.
And instead,
ice.
It's alive, it's flowing, it's vibrant, and there's all kinds of activity that now we have to go back to the drawing board and come up with new theories to understand.
In fact, I remember the heart-shaped patch when those photos came out. That was ice, basically, glaciers?
It's a glacier the size of Texas and Oklahoma combined, made of nitrogen ice. And it was basically born yesterday. We can't find any craters on it, which means that it's very young. It hasn't been out there very long.
How can such a cold planet that I always thought was just going to be practically absolute zero, how can so much be happening on it?
Because there's an engine on the inside that's operating all of that geology. And that's what David said. We don't understand how that is, but in fact, that's what nature does. And we have to figure it out now.
It's made of these familiar materials in really exotic conditions. So here on Earth, we have nitrogen. That's what we're breathing mostly in the atmosphere. On Pluto, the nitrogen is frozen out on the surface as a giant glacier. And we didn't really understand the properties of a giant nitrogen glacier on that scale at those temperatures until we got there and saw it behaving. And now the physicists are having a field day going back and saying, okay, let's figure out why this is behaving the way it is.
Does a planet's size have anything to do with how active it is? You talked about it being the size of a continent.
Yeah, we used to think that smaller worlds would be simpler.
Uh-huh.
Pluto completely defied that expectation. It has all the complexity of Earth or Mars.
By the way, how, just so I can imagine it, I'm picturing the Little Prince, if you ever saw the like the little boy on the on the tiny planet. If I were living on Pluto, how often would I see a sunrise?
Every 6.5 days.
6.5 days. A sunrise. Oh wait, so I would, okay. That's because it's so far from.
No, it's just because it turns slowly on its axis.
Oh, it turns slowly. Okay.
Yeah. But you would also, if you were on the right part of Pluto, you would see a giant moon in the sky, this moon Charon, which would be beautiful, huge, looming in the sky. But the funny thing is you'd have to be on the right part of Pluto to see it because it orbits with Pluto's rotation. So if you're on the wrong side, you'd never see that giant moon. If you're on the right side, you'd always see it.
It just hangs stationary over that side of the planet.
The stealthiest moon. So does the fact that Pluto has, did you say multiple moons?
It has five.
Is that part of the case you make for Pluto being a planet?
Well, its planethood has to do with what Pluto is, not what it's surrounded by. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you saw Pluto show up on the viewfinder of the Starship Enterprise on an episode, you would identify that as there must be a planet. It's not a star. It's not an asteroid. It's not a galaxy or an alien spaceship.
Did your photos add to the case for Pluto being a... Are we talking about whether it's a planet or a dwarf planet?
Well, dwarf planets are a type of planet. Yeah. No, the sun is a dwarf star. It doesn't make it not a star.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, part of what...
Well, what's at stake here? It's just we're not going to bother teaching it to kids because there's lots of dwarf planets just as big as Pluto, and that's that. So there has to be a cutoff?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually very little at stake. The whole thing was kind of misguided, and, you know, what's really important is that there's all these worlds out there that are amazing, not what you call them, but the fact is a dwarf planet is a perfectly respectable term for this small kind of planet. And if they had just said that, the astronomers would have been fine. But they added this sort of nonsensical coda to their definition, which said a dwarf planet is not a planet.
But, you know, the other thing that's important is that the United States showed it's on its game. It explored a place 3 billion miles away. No other nation on Earth, no other space program on Earth can touch that kind of feat. We did it in one try, and we did it perfectly.
That was launched... How many years ago, though? What does it say about the U.S. and space exploration now?
It was launched in 2006, arrived in 2015, and it shows that NASA's on its game. So is the United States.
And by the way, New Horizons is still going and still operating, and there's going to be another encounter with an unknown world this coming New Year's Eve. This small object called Ultima Thule that we don't even really know very much about other than that it's small and it's by far the farthest thing we will have ever explored.
But what's so important about that? Because the Kuiper Belt lies beyond, what, Neptune, is it? And so there's a bunch of little objects out there. What's so important about Ultima Thule?
Well, it's a representative of this whole zone of the solar system that we've barely explored. Before Pluto, we had never been anywhere in the Kuiper Belt. And we've explored one object and its moons out there, one planet. But there's trillions of objects in the Kuiper Belt. And the small ones are leftover building blocks from making planets. It's sort of like it's the attic of the solar system. It's the leftover pieces. And we've never been to one of those. And this is the stuff that the planets were made out of. So I think we stand to learn, you know, not just about exploring this cool new place, type of place that we've never been to, but potentially some important stories about how the planets all formed and how the solar system got to be the way it is.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up because I'll ask you the annoying question, which is, so what? You know, so we learn stuff. And what would we, is it just, well, you know, discovery is amazing and it's the human spirit, or is it that and we're going to learn vital information that's going to save humanity from doom?
It is about the heart and the head. It is about understanding our universe and our origins, but it's also about this nation's soft power projection. And it's frankly about inspiring children to STEM careers. This entire economy, Seattle knows that better than anywhere, is powered by engineers and scientists. And space exploration inspires kids to go into those very hard fields like electrical engineering, like computer science, like physics, more than any other. That's a documented fact. And we received so many letters, so many tweets, so many other kinds of contacts from parents and children alike when we explored Pluto, saying, that's what I want to grow up and do. That turned my kid on. That turned their grades around. They were inspired by that. Now, what could be better than that, honestly?
And by the way, it's also going to help us save the world. Because without a space program, we'd be sunk. We've got challenges like climate change, and the planet is changing without Earth observations, without space platforms, and without comparative planetology to understand how Earth works by looking elsewhere. We would be flying blind on this planet. So I think there is a pragmatic sense in which we need to understand how planets work, and this kind of exploration helps us do it.
Doctors David Grinspoon and Alan Stern, they're speaking tonight at the Museum of Flight south of Seattle tonight, 7:30, and their book is Chasing New Horizons. What a pleasure. Thank you to both of you.
Thanks
Great
a lot.
Being here.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back.
To melt in your icy blue hole. Should I?